Session number 16075, Reel 1.
Group Captain Goodman, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Northampton.
Which year was this?
January 1921.
What did your father do for a living?
Oh, he was in the building industry.
Did you go to school in Northampton?
Yes.
And how old were you when you finished your schooling?
16.
To do what?
Well, I started off then to be a dental mechanic, making artificial teeth. And this is something I did until the war began, in fact.
How and when did you join the Air Force?
Well, it started off in September 1938, at the time of the Munich crisis, when I realised that the war was coming and I got to do something that I wanted to do, and I didn't much fancy becoming an infantryman. I had visions of the trenches in the First World War, and I decided that I would like to fly. I'd always been very keen on flying, and I read every book on the aces of the First World War that I could find, and my father took me to see a display by Alan Cobham and his flying circus at a meadow outside Northampton in, it must have been, oh, about 1929, something like that, when I was about 8 years old. And I greatly admired these people tearing around in their flying machines, and this really triggered me off. So that in September 1938, I joined an organisation called the Air Defence Cadet Corps, which was the forerunner of the Air Training Corps. And in Northampton, we had a squadron which was called Number 5 Squadron. It was Number 5 brackets founder, close brackets, squadron of the ADCC. And our CO was Squadron Leader Brown, and he'd been a camel pilot in the First World War. He flew sop with camels. Whether he was any good at flying them, I don't know. He didn't wear any medals, I noticed that, but we thought he was God. And when the time came, when I started to come to my 18th birthday in January 1939, I squared up to Squadron Leader Brown and asked him whether he thought I could get into the Air Force as a pilot. And he said, well, the thing you want to do, my boy, is to join the RAF Volunteer Reserve, which flies at Sewell. He said that you could keep on doing your civilian job and you could find out about flying and do some flying, and you get paid for it as well. So it was arranged that I should go to the town centre of the Northampton squadron of the RAFVR, and about 25 of us went on this particular day, and only three of us got through. The test we did, we had an oral test and a bit of a written test, not much. But then we had the medical test, and people were falling down on this right and left. And as I say, only three of us got through, and I was one of them. And then after that, it was a question of waiting to go to Sewell and start flying. And I started to do this at the beginning of May 1939. And between then and the end of August, I did 32 hours flying, which was quite a lot. I even got a fortnight's holiday from work in order to go up there and do some extra flying, which was good. And I was foolish enough to think that when the balloon went up, we would all be hurled into action against the Germans. But of course, that was not to be. We were sent to Hastings, an initial training wing, to learn drill and RAF administration and all those important things that people seem not to want to do. And we were there only a few weeks, and I was posted from there up to Brough, near Hull, where we started to fly Blackburn B-2 aircraft, which were like Tiger Moths, only they were side-by-side trainers. The instructor and the student sat alongside each other. So this thing was rather like a pregnant Tiger Moth. It was fat, and it had a Gypsy Major engine, like the Tiger, but it was grossly underpowered. The thing developed lots and lots of drag. If I remember it, it used to do everything at 70 miles an hour. It climbed at 70, it flew straight and level at 70, it approached to land at 70, and you had an awful job to do any aerobatics. It was a real pig of an aeroplane, and it was thrown out of service in, I think, early 1942, discarded completely. But the thing about the Blackburn B-2 was that you had to fly it very carefully. And I learnt an awful lot. And in the winter of 1939, which was a bad winter, there was no posting to other places because they were all waterlogged or covered in mud. And so we stayed at Brough alongside the River Humber and just flew B-2s all the time. And I did something like 80 hours on B-2s when I was supposed to do 50, which was very good, elementary training that stood me in good stead. But in March 40, we then went to Hallabington, number 9 Service Flying Training School, where I started to fly Anson's. I wanted to fly Hart's and Audax aircraft, and we had a selection board presided over by a squadron leader, and he asked, "What do you want to do, my boy?" And I said, "I'd like to be a fighter pilot, sir." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "My reports have been very good on aerobatics and so on." He said, "Yes, yes, that's quite right." And then I put my foot in it and saying that in any case I didn't like the idea of bombing women and children. And this, of course, really set him going, and he told me in no uncertain terms that I'd better watch my P's and Q's and that the RAF didn't go in for that sort of thing. And I blundered straight into that one and said, "You can't tell me that if the war goes on any length of time we shan't be killing women and children." And he very coldly said to me, "You had better join the bomber flight and learn what it's all about." And so I did. That was the end of my chances of becoming a fighter pilot. I expect if I'd become a fighter pilot, of course, as this was getting on towards Battle of Britain time, I'd have been shot to pieces. So maybe it was a good thing. Anyway, I got my wings on the 10th of May 1940, and I remember it well because that was the day the Germans attacked in the Low Countries, the beginning of their devastating attack through France, which rolled up France and Belgium and Holland and caused the British Army to come out of Dunkirk in a great hurry. From Hallabington, I was sent to Harwell, 15 operational training unit, to learn to fly Wellingtons, which I did, and I got onto a Wellington squadron in the middle of August 1940. And the Battle of Britain was at its height by then, and the Wellingtons were all bombed up, ready to go bombing the Germans if they came across to invade, which looked as if they would for a while, of course. And they were massing barges in all the ports along the Channel coast and up to Holland, and in the end they massed something like 1,900 of these huge, great flat-bottom barges, powered barges you see going up and down the Rhine. And we were tasked, when these dock basins were full, to attack them at night. And of course in those days you could find the target without any bother at night, because you could find a coast and you only had to wander up and down the coast and you came across a port with docks with these things in. And we just bombed them. We didn't know what sort of results we were achieving. Of course we went on night after night doing this. Had we known it, the results were very good indeed. We didn't know, of course, that the German top secret code Enigma had been broken, and that Winston Churchill was getting a report every day on what was going on, because the people, the Germans in France, were telling the high command exactly what was happening, and we were reading their signals, and Churchill was getting it the next morning. So he was soon aware that about 12.5% of these barges were being destroyed by these night bomber attacks by Wellingtons and Hamdens and Whitleys. We would have been very bucked if we'd known it.
But you weren't actually in a squadron by this time.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm sorry. Didn't I say I joined 37 Squadron at Feltwell? Yes, I'm sorry. Middle of August 1940, I joined 37 Squadron at Feltwell, near Ely. So we were doing this, and another thing we didn't know happened on the 15th of September, which is always regarded as the great day, victory day in the Battle of Britain, when you remember it was said that we had shot down 185 German aeroplanes, and it turned out not to be that, it was 60-something. But the great thing about it was that the Germans made two attacks that day, and on the second attack, all of Fighter Command, or what was left of it, rose up and really sorted them out, and they broke and fled. But what happened that day was that the German High Command in Berlin sent a signal to the unit that was responsible for training all the air landing troops that were coming over to land in this country as part of the invasion. That was where the headquarters was, at Schiphol outside Amsterdam. And the officer commanding received this signal from Berlin, which told him that his whole organisation was to be disbanded forthwith. And this, of course, was read by the decoders at Bletchley Park and was in Churchill's hands very quickly. So there was a meeting of the chiefs of staff that day, and they all knew at once that the invasion, the seaborne invasion, was not going to happen. Again, at Feltwell, had we known this, we would have been very bucked. But we didn't.
What did you think of flying the Wellington in those days?
Oh, well, the Wimpy was an immensely tough aeroplane, of course. It was made of geodetic construction. Barnes Wallace designed it. It was rather like a trellis work. It could take an enormous amount of battle damage. And it had radial engines. It didn't have glycol as the Merlins did, so you could get the engine peppered with shrapnel and it would still keep going. You could have one or two rocker boxes knocked off and the engine would still keep going. It's quite incredible what it would do. But with a Merlin, you'd only got to get one bit of flak through your coolant radiator and that was the end of it. The coolant would pour out and then the engine would seize, as happened to me in a Mosquito later on. I never lost an engine in a Wellington, and we were beaten up frequently. But she would take a tremendous amount of battle damage and still get home. So I have great affection for the Wimpy.
When you say you were beaten up, was that by flak?
Flak, yes. I was attacked by a fighter once, which was not very pleasant. There was a tremendous tearing noise at the back as this thing came in firing cannons. And then a crunching of enormous feet coming up the fuselage. Crunch, crunch, crunch. And then it stopped, thank God, as the thing broke away. Of course, I was diving like hell at the time, too, and I really thought the aeroplane was going to fall to pieces or blow up, but it didn't. It had got holes in it, and we came back safely.
Was that in one of these invasion barge attacks?
No, it was over Germany. After we'd finished bombing the invasion barges, we went on with bombing Germany. One of the favourite targets was Ham, the marshalling yards at Ham, and we would go to, after the oil refinery at Gelsenkirchen, for example. They were all legitimate targets, but we couldn't find them because everywhere being blacked out, you couldn't see details on the ground. You could see the coast when you crossed it, and the navigator could then work out a wind, which had then got to carry you through hundreds of miles of enemy territory, perhaps, before you got to your target, and then back again. And, of course, the wind would change. It would drop, or it would veer, or it back. And so you could be miles and miles out. And even though you dropped a flare to find out where you were, you very often just see open fields underneath. So it was very difficult to find targets, unless the Germans started to fire at you, and then you could turn towards where the firing came from and you'd be over a town or a city which you might or might not be able to identify. In those days we used to have a primary target, which might be, say, Gelsenkirchen, and there'd be a secondary target some distance away which would be a similar kind of target, and you would go for that. And if you couldn't find either of those, you would go for something called SEMO or MOPA, S-E-M-O or M-O-P-A. S-E-M-O was self-evident military objective, and MOPA was military objective previously attacked. So often it was SEMO or MOPA that we would go for. And I do remember one night that we were SEMO or MOPA-ing, and we came upon a railway line with a train puffing along it, and we thought that this was a jolly good military objective, and it was a goods train, and we flew over the top of it and dropped bombs, which exploded. We were flying at about 2,000 feet, and we turned away at the end of this bombing run, and the train had stopped. And suddenly, to our astonishment, there was a most enormous explosion in the middle of the train. And it was an ammunition train, and the thing blew up, went off in all directions. I think that was probably one of the most successful trips I ever did on 37th Squadron, with this thing blowing to pieces all around. And of course, we scuttled out of the way. It was near Soest, in the Ruhr. But as I say, most of the time, we were not hitting targets, because we couldn't find them. And that brought about a change in bombing policy, which was that we had got to go for cities. We've got to find a big target, and we had got to go for them, because in them, of course, were all the sinews of war. There were chemical factories, and there were, ammunition works probably as well, and there were engineering works of all kinds. The sinews of war were there. So if you could find the city and bomb the middle of it, very likely you would be able to bomb some of these factories and knock them out. Of course, in the end, when we were going for places like the Krupp works at Essen, doing it with radar, we could find these places, and of course we really could blow them to pieces. But in the beginning, it wasn't so. And we must have wasted thousands of tons of bombs blowing holes in fields at the time. And this was well realised. Later on, it was realised that we had got to have possibly some of the more dedicated crews to go ahead of the rest and really find a target. That was the beginning of the Pathfinder force, which meant that the main force would come on behind, the Pathfinders ahead would lay markers on the target which they had to find somehow, and then the bombing could really start. And of course in 1942 we got two aides to navigation. One was G, which was G, and this was a radar aid which depended upon pulses sent out from two widely separated stations in this country. And the navigator, using a special G map which had lattice lines crisscrossing all over it, could plot the position of the aircraft within about 3 miles of an aiming point. And G would reach as far as the Ruhr, which was good, because the Ruhr really was the place that held most of the Germans' ability to fight the war. The other aid was H2S, and this was an airborne aid, which means that it had in it a magnetron valve, and it was a downward-looking radar which surveyed the ground over which the aeroplane was flying, and the navigator had a what was more or less like a television set up. He could see the ground over which the aircraft was going. He could identify things like lakes and rivers, and he had special H2S maps as well. So this had no limit on range, which meant that you could fly all over Germany. You could go to the Ruhr, you could go to Berlin, you could go to Munich using this aid, and it was very effective. Very effective for finding a target area, but not for pinpoint marking of a target. That still had to come later. Using G, in 1943, the Ruhr was wrecked by a series of huge bomber raids, and Germany had more damage inflicted on her in the summer of 1943 than throughout the whole of the war before. It was a tremendous effort, and we lost an awful lot of aeroplanes and an awful lot of men. But Germany began to bleed, and this is what we were trying to do to bring her to her knees.
Did you take part in any of those raids?
No. I was on so-called rest in those days at Harwell. My own tour ended in May 1941. I finished my tour at Feltwell, or my time at Feltwell rather, in the middle of October 1940, when 37th Squadron flew off to the Middle East. for some unaccountable reason, I had an attack of flu and was in sick quarters, and they flew away without me, so my crew went off with somebody else. I was then what was called, I was a pilot without a crew, and the group headquarters, number three group headquarters, decided that I had better go to 99 Squadron at Newmarket, because there was a crew that had done half its tour, and its pilot, a New Zealander, was posted away. There they were, a headless crew, and here was I, a pilot without a crew, so we were married up together. And I met these people, and they looked at me, and I looked at them. And in those days, of course, you were very jealous of your crew members. You didn't want to fly with anybody else. And the people I'd flown with it felt, well, as far as I was concerned, were the tops. So looking at this lot, I thought, my goodness, I don't know how we are all going to get along. And I suppose they looked at me and thought, we've been flying with Ginger Rothwell for months, and we don't like the look of this fellow at all. And then I was allocated an aeroplane. His name was, its letter, initial letter, identification letter was R, R for Robert. And it was one of the two Jinx aeroplanes of the squadron. Every squadron had a Jinx aeroplane. And this was an aircraft to which anything would happen. Anything awful that was going to happen would happen to that aeroplane. And it would go missing at the drop of a hat. And there was one in A flight. I was in B flight, by the way. A flight's Jinx was B for Bertie, and B flight's Jinx was R for Robert. B for Bertie went down the night I got to Newmarket, which is where 99 was located. We flew from the Rowley Mile, and we lived in the grandstand, and very cold it was in the winter of 1940. B for Bertie had the most experienced pilot of the squadron on board, and he was on almost his last trip. There was a great loss of morale when he went, and so everybody looked at me then as the character who'd come in to take the other Jinx, and Corporal Tosh Hoskins, who was the corporal in charge of the aeroplane, said to me, you know, he said, old R is a Jinx. And I said to him very bravely that I had no intention of going down in R for Robert or any other aeroplane on 99 Squadron. Brave words, but oddly prophetic, because while I was on the squadron, I went on leave twice with my crew. We used to have 7 days every 6 weeks leave, whether we liked it or not, and of course we liked it. Each time I went on leave and someone else took Arthur Robert, the aircraft didn't come back, which was, I think, absolutely astounding, and the Jinx was preserved. B for Bertie was also a very unlucky aircraft. The factory workers at Broughton, the Wellington factory up near Blackpool, presented Bomber Command with a Wellington, which the workers paid for themselves. It was called the Broughton Bomber, and it had the emblem of the works on it, the logo of the works on the side of it, and a small crowd of people came from the works to see this bomber take off on its first trip. And it was allocated to one of our flight lieutenants. It took off on the Rowley Mile, heading towards the southwest. It got airborne, and nobody really knows how, but it hit the top of the Devil's Dyke on the southwest end of Newmarket and crashed and burst into flames and was burnt up, and they were all killed. So that was the Broughton Bomber. What the people at the factory thought about it, I don't know, having forked out £30,000 to buy this aeroplane. To see it go up in smoke on its first operational takeoff must have been quite something. But that was it, and that was war. I suppose at Newmarket, the thing I remember most of all was when I was getting towards the end of my tour. You see, when you started your tour, you were a greenhorn, and you weren't quite sure what was going to happen, and you felt very vulnerable. But as time went on, you began to get more acclimatized to flying in Bomber Command, and you didn't exactly get overconfident about it. You were always a bit wary, but you gained in confidence all the time, and you felt that you might survive. And of course, as you became more senior as a pilot, you realized that the junior pilots were looking to you. Every trip you notched up was more encouragement to them, because the chances of filling, of completing a tour of 30 trips in those days wasn't all that good. And you, if you were a senior pilot, would look at senior pilots around you and think, well, as long as old Smith can keep going, I'm all right, you see. And that was fine until suddenly old Smith didn't come back. And then you realised that everybody was looking at you. And this was terrible. You felt really out in front and you felt really vulnerable. But, of course, if you were lucky, and I was lucky, you survived and you got away with it.
What about this business that we hear about of lack of moral fibre in the world? Did you ever come across that?
Yes, once only. And this was, I felt very sorry for the crew. This was on Lancasters. When I got to the Mosquito Squadron at Oakington at the end of 1943, 627 Squadron, the Pathfinder Lancaster Squadron at Oakington was number 7. And they had 18 crews. They put up 18 aircraft on a maximum effort. And they were in a situation one day where they got to put up a maximum effort of 18. And suddenly, the pilot, they only had one pilot then in those days. At the beginning of the war, when I flew with 37 and 99, we had two pilots always, a first pilot and a second pilot. But later on, we had only one. And the pilot of one of these aeroplanes went sick. He got a filthy cold. Well, you just weren't allowed to fly if you got a bad cold, because you were liable to damage your ears. So he was told he was grounded. But they still needed a maximum effort, and they hadn't another crew. And so this particular crew without a pilot was allocated a new pilot who'd just come in. And he's a man that I knew personally, a very good chap. He'd done one tour already on Wellingtons, but he hadn't done any Pathfinder trips at all. And they briefed him to take this crew and this particular aeroplane. Well, the crew didn't like it, and they told poor old Ralph that they weren't very keen, and he said, well, he realised that, but they were all in it together, so they might just as well get on with it. But as the day wore on, the navigator and the rear gunner, the navigator was a warrant officer and the rear gunner was a flight sergeant, got together and they decided they really did not like it, and they squared up to the flight commander and said they didn't like it at all, and they would do any number of trips with their own pilot, only please don't let them go with this one. And he said that that wasn't possible, it was a maximum effort and they'd got to go. And that was that. So the briefing was done and they attended briefing, and that was the point of no return. If you were briefed to go, you'd got to go. They got out to dispersal to go, and then they dug their toes in and said they wouldn't go. And so the flight commander squared up to them and said, I order you to go. And they said, sir, we're very sorry, but we can't. He said, you mean you won't? Yes. So they were both placed under close arrest. They were both court-martialed, and they were both reduced to the ranks and posted elsewhere to menial duties. I was very sorry, because they were apparently both good chaps, but they felt they couldn't go any further. Of course, you couldn't allow that sort of thing to happen. Once that sort of thing started to spread around squadrons, everybody would start to do it. And so that was it. You had to make an example of people like that. That's the only time I ever came across lack of moral fibre.
Sorry, that question rather interrupted what you were saying about your experiences with 99 Squadron.
Yes.
You were talking about how the question of morale in the unit and being up front.
Yes, yes. I bore a charmed life, there's no doubt about it. And in 78 raids in Bomber Command, I was never scratched myself, and I never had any crew member who flew with me so much as scratched either.